Welcome to the first lecture in the Graduate Institute Summer Lecture Series. I'm David McDonald, the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs here at Santa Fe. And I'm pleased to welcome my colleague, Grant Franks, longtime tutor at the college, who's going to, I think, in short, tell you why you ought to read Ulysses.
That's the plan.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. How many people here have read Ulysses? Well, that's great. I don't want to talk to you particularly. I want to talk to the other people.
Thank you.
I'm glad you came, but my main purpose here is to try to explain why it is someone who hasn't read Ulysses ought to do so. I want to try to describe a few things about the book, give you some little bit of background, tell you what you're going to find in it, what I think you're going to find in it, give a few examples of the prose that you're going to hear in it, and some tips. But mostly what I want to do is dispel the idea that is out there that Ulysses is some sort of a mountain of literary pretension that you would never climb unless you wanted to get some sort of geeky academic merit badge. I don't think that's true. I know there are people out there who like to give that idea. I think it's because they think the value of their merit badges will go down if people find out that it's fun. But Ulysses is fun, and that's what I want to try to get across. Joyce began writing Ulysses in 1914, just as Europe was beginning on that sort of immense orgy of mass self-destruction and slaughter, that it was called the Great War until a bigger war came along and they had to rename it and it became World War I. It was published, Ulysses was published in 1922. And for those of you who find these sorts of things interesting, there's a big long story about the publication history. It involves obscenity laws and little art house presses and French publishers who are trying to skirt the law and trying to publish a book they don't understand because it's in English, and American legal procedures and a bunch of other stuff that's really fun and interesting, but it's not the main point that I want to get into today. What I want to do is focus on the book itself. And for purposes of just getting you started with it, I think it would be helpful to know a little bit about the setting. Where's my clip?
I have here it is.
Yes. The events that Ulysses talks about all take place on one day, June 16th, 1904, and in one place, Dublin, Ireland. Joyce is meticulous, even obsessive, about attention to details of government politics, geography, mannerism, customs, but he's not that good at explaining the context of what he's giving you. Fortunately, you can get started with it without a lot of background. A few broad strokes I think will be helpful, and I hope you'll excuse me if I begin with something that might seem obvious. It's useful to know that in 1904, Ireland was part of the United Kingdom. It was governed from London. Relations between Ireland and England had been strained for centuries. Ireland is predominantly Catholic, was and still is. England is has been, since the time of Henry VIII, Protestant. And this has been the beginning of strained relations for centuries. In the early 20th century, the tensions between Ireland and England had given rise to a resurgence of a kind of romantic Irish nationalism. The Irish language, which had gone nearly extinct, was being revived. Irish sports, like hurling. There was a movement to revive distinctively Irish sports. In the literary world, there was something called the Irish Literary Renaissance. Figures like William Butler Yeats and John Millington Synge turned literature, turned their writing back to a romanticization of a peasant Irish past and themes focused on Irish myth and legend. Joyce was well aware of these things. Some of the characters from the Irish Renaissance appear in Ulysses. Joyce didn't want anything to do with that stuff. That was not what he was doing. Politically, There have been Irish Catholic rebellions against English rule off and on for centuries. There would be more in the future. In 1916, of course, Easter, in 1916, there begins the Easter Uprising, a sequence of political violence that ultimately leads to the detachment of the Republic of Ireland from the United Kingdom. But on June 16th, 1904, that's in the future. There have been rebellions in the past, there'll be rebellions in the future, but on this day, Dublin is a peaceful town, city, major city, in the British Islands, part of the United Kingdom. A peace that we, the readers, know, but the characters don't know, is not going to last. The characters of Ulysses, there are dozens, hundreds of characters in Ulysses, but there are three principal characters. First, Stephen Dennis. If you've read Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, you all have met Stephen Dedalus. That book ends with Stephen about to leave Ireland to go to France to pursue his life as a writer. Ulysses begins with Stephen coming back to Ireland a short time later to attend. He's come to attend the deathbed of his mother, who has died a few weeks before the beginning, before June 16th. Stephen is a neurotic bundle of inner tensions. He's cocky and egocentric, but wrapped with self-doubt. He's a liberated freethinker, most of whose thoughts are shaped by Thomas Aquinas. He's an ascetic who thinks constantly about sex. He desperately wants to make his mark on the Dublin literary scene, but he despises the people that he wants to impress. Physically, also, he's a mess. He doesn't bathe. His teeth are bad. He cares so little about his body that he goes for days without eating, though he does drink a lot. He's hanging around Dublin picking up some money as a teacher in a school in the south part of town, actually outside of town, a little town south of Dublin, within walking distance. Picking up some money that he wastes very readily, and living with a friend, Buck Mulligan, whom he distrusts, in an old disused military fortification that the town rents out for cheap. Unrelated to Stephen is Leopold Bloom. Leopold Bloom, we have not seen before. He makes his first appearance in Ulysses. He's 38 years old enough, although just barely, to be Stephen's father. He's married and himself the father of two. His daughter, Millie, is 15 years old. She's just recently left town to get a job in another city. His son, Rudy, died a few days after he was born, 11 years ago. A catastrophe that left a serious mark in Bloom's life, and especially on his marriage. He's working as an advertising canvasser. His religious background is confused. His family comes from Hungary and were Jews until his father came to England, converted to Protestantism. Bloom himself converted to Catholicism when he married his wife, but is really not terribly serious about any religious issues that we can tell. The third major character is his wife, Molly Bloom. Molly grew up with her father in Gibraltar. She's a professional singer. She's 5 years younger than her husband. And on the day in question, June 16th, 1904, she is planning to commence an extramarital affair with her music manager, Blaise Boylan. She appears in only two episodes of the book, numbers 4 and 18, but the thought of Molly dominates the mind of Leopold throughout the text. She, in fact, her thoughts fill the final episode, episode 18, so she has the final word in the book, Ulysses. As for the events of the book, as you can tell, it's long. And that can be a little bit off-putting. But I urge you not to be too concerned about the fact that it's long, because It's broken up into bite-sized pieces. It's broken up into 18 chapters, or they're usually called episodes, probably because each episode is somewhat self-contained and forms a kind of a stylistic unit of its own. So the word chapter, which implies a kind of continuity, anyway, they're usually called episodes. The episodes are grouped together. The first three make part one, the last three make part three, and the 12 in the middle make part two. Now the sequence of the episodes brings us face to face with a kind of a puzzling feature about Ulysses, because the names of the episodes show connections between what's going on in the book and Homer's Odyssey. So you've got, and they're listed on the handout too, Telemachus, Nestor, and Proteus make up the Telemachia. The last episodes, Eumaeus, Ithaca, Penelope are the return, and the middle 12 are the wanderings of Odysseus, Calypso, Lotus Eaters, Hades, Aeolus, Laestrygonians, Scylla and Charybdis, Wandering Rock, Sirens, Cyclops, Nausicaa, Oxen of the Sun, and Circe. The reason they make a problem for us is that these names are well known to students of Joyce and students of Ulysses. But if you're a naive reader and you just pick up and read the book, you wouldn't see them. They're not in the book. Joyce himself is to blame for this problem, as for so much else. He gave the episodes their names. He communicated the names to friends of his and made sure that they appeared in early commentaries on the work. Joyce scholars talk about them all the time and go on endlessly about the parallelisms between Homer and Ulysses, but you wouldn't see them, or you might not think about them, without the names, which, as I say, are not in the book. So that leaves us with a problem. Do you focus on the parallels because Joyce was thinking about them, or do you deliberately not think about them because he decided not to put them in the book? This is a problem, and I'll talk some more about it in a minute. But first, I just want to run through kind of quickly what happens. It's a way in which what happens is not the most important thing in Ulysses. It's more important how it happens. We'll get to that. I want to talk just briefly, just so we have together an impression of what happens in Ulysses. So we have the timeline from 8 in the morning, midnight here, 3 in the next morning. The book opens with Telemachus. Stephen and his friend Buck Mulligan are at an old tower where they live. Stephen quarrels with Mulligan and vows not to come home that night. Nestor. Stephen is teaching in a school in a nearby suburban town. He quarrels with his employer and vows not to return to his job. Stephen, now unemployed and homeless, walks along a beach, thinks about life, the universe, and the first three episodes together, part one, a kind of a downward motion. Episode 4, Calypso, begins the day again. So we start again at 8 a.m. Bloom is at home, fixing breakfast for himself and for Molly. It's during this episode that a letter gets delivered. He gets the morning mail, and there are suspicions. He has suspicions about the upcoming affair with Poison Boiling. Lotus Eater, he spends the rest of the day doing errands around town. Lotus Eaters, he visits a post office and a chemist shop. He also takes a bath. Hades, he attends the funeral of an acquaintance. Aeolus, he goes to a newspaper office to transact some business. He almost runs into Stephen, who's there to talk to the editors about literary matters. Laestrygonians, Bloom has lunch. Scylla and Charybdis, Bloom goes to the National Library. Again, he almost meets Stephen. A lot of the episode turns out to be about Stephen, who's trying to impress the Dublin literati with Stephen's theories about Shakespeare. Episode 10 is rather strange. The book as a whole is rather strange. It's stranger. It's not about either Stephen or Bloom. It's little vignettes of life all around Dublin. Episode 12, we come back now. 11, rather. 11 through 15 are the big monster chapters of the book. Sirens. Bloom has an early dinner at a hotel where he overhears a number of men singing in the next room. Cyclops. He goes to a bar and gets into an argument with a blustery Irish nationalist bigot. 13. He comes to the same beach that Stephen was on back in episode 3, where he sees a young girl who displays herself provocatively and he masturbates. Oxen of the Sun. It's now 8 in the evening, or 9 in the evening, I guess. Bloom visits a maternity hospital to ask after a woman that he knows who's having a child. Stephen and his friends are there having a party in the waiting room. I've never figured out why that makes sense. Whether that was common in Ireland at the time, this place to have parties, but there it was. Leopold joins them and watches after Stephen, who's rather drunk. After the party breaks up, 15, Circe. Stephen leaves Bloom to a bordello where things happen that can only be described as surreal. That's the end of part 2. Part 3, after the events of the bordello, Stephen takes Stephen to a late night, what they call cabin shelter, these little all-night coffee stands, where they have something to eat and drink. In episode 17, they go back to Bloom's house and have something more to drink. They have a conversation. Stephen decides that he declines not to stay at Bloom's house for the night. They go to the backyard and urinate. Stephen leaves. Bloom goes to bed. And finally, 18, Penelope, Molly lying awake in bed, reflects on her affair with Boylan, her relation to Leopold, life, God, the universe, and everything. The events of the book. Now, in light of this, you might reasonably ask at this point, isn't this all just a little bit ad ta? One damn thing after another. And it would be if this had been what Joyce had written, the summary. But Ulysses is more than these events. Now, what that more is something that gets talked about a lot by people who have read and love the book. I'm going to tell you that there are four things that that make the effort of reading Ulysses altogether worthwhile. And I'll just say at the outset, that if you talk to someone else who knows the book well, they'll tell you that I'm wrong, and they'll tell you what they think are the important things. But with that disclaimer, I'll tell you what the truth is now, and you get the other thing. The four things are universality of character, immensity of style, imminence of the myth, and humor. By universality of character, what I mean is this, that even if there were no other reason to read Ulysses, the character of Leopold Bloom would be enough. On the surface, he does not seem like much. People call him an everyman because he doesn't seem to have any special qualities. He's not a great writer like Stephen. He's not an explorer. He's not a politician. He's not a hero, quite like Ulysses, or Odysseus, rather. He's not an inventor. But there are things that set him apart. Mostly, I think what sets him apart is the openness of his mind. And what I've written here is the acuity of his observation. I think peculiarity of his observation might be a better way to put it. He has a turn of mind that's worth knowing about, worth coming to know. One of the most remarkable things about Bloom is that James Joyce ever conceived him at all. It's easy to see why James Joyce created a character like Stephen Dedalus, because Stephen Dedalus is pretty much James Joyce, a tortured artist who gives all and pays no attention to anyone else's needs in pursuance of his art. What's harder to understand is how he would come up with someone like Bloom, because Bloom and Stephen are pretty much polar opposites. Stephen is poetic. Bloom is pedestrian. Stephen is young. Bloom is middle-aged. Stephen is arrogant. It's hard to explain. Well, he is. Bloom is self-effacing. Stephen is quick to take offense. Leopold forgives very easily. Stephen is a tormented last Catholic. Leopold is an indifferent last Jew. Stephen is Irish. In the eyes of everyone else, Leopold is Hungarian. He was born in Ireland, but no one else in Dublin thinks of him that way. They think of him as a foreigner. Stephen is often drunk. Leopold is always sober. Stephen is careless with money. Leopold is meticulous and thrifty. At the end of the book, in episode 17, you get an account of every shilling that has passed through his hands during the day. Stephen is seldom bathes. Leopold is very clean. And we actually see him taking a bath in episode 5. Stephen skips meals. Leopold loves his food and eats frequently. Stephen is sexually naive. Bloom is a married father of two. Stephen is self-absorbed. Leopold is charitable and outgoing. Creating a character so far from himself, as Joyce has done in making Leopold Bloom, and making him as sympathetic, as hugely sympathetic as he is, Joyce, I think, takes a supreme imaginative leap. In bringing these two characters, Bloom and Stephen, together, I think he makes a sort of a universal character. Because Stephen and Bloom together make a sort of a yin and yang of reality, or almost so. Not quite, because there's one characteristic they have in common. They're gender, they're both men, and they're moving together in the male-dominated world of 1904 Dublin. But Joyce overcomes that as well, or at least moves toward an overcome that. But when he brings us, in episode 18, an intimate portrait of Molly Bloom, and together the three make at least a gesture toward a universality of character whose range and depth is what I think you might call worth the whole price of admission. So if there was no other reason to read the book, I think getting to know Leopold Bloom would be enough. But there's more. The immensity of style. Ulysses is a book that does not let you ignore style. People who talk about Ulysses often talk about the stream of consciousness or the inner monologue style. And it's certainly a part of the book. That technique is powerful, and it has kind of mixed results. Two things that it does. One thing is that it gives you a very intimate picture of the character whom you're meeting. We know Bloom and Stephen more intimately, I think, than we know almost any other character in literature. The mental life of the character is right there on the page with you. On the other hand, the other thing it does is to emphasize the character's loneliness, because the thoughts that we have access to are, as far as the characters are concerned, private. They're private. We see them as they appear to themselves, alone, isolated, in conversation with themselves alone. So we get to know them, but we get to know them in a way that emphasizes their loneliness. The inner monologue is important, and it dominates the early chapters of Ulysses, but it is far from the only kind of style that you see. As you follow the course of the book, the inner monologue becomes less and less evident, and alternative styles make themselves appear. The characters, during the wanderings of Bloom, we get into wilder, stranger, funnier, and more exotic styles. And as the styles open up, I think the characters open up with them. Stephen and Bloom first appear to us in that inner monologue, in the isolation of their thoughts. But as we go forward, the outer world, which is told in a third-person narrative, becomes less the flat and empty world of simple extension and takes on a character of its own. Thought and feeling are no longer confined to the inner world to pervade the outer scenes in ways that are very curious. And it's in that transformed world, where the barriers between the outer and the inner have been breached, that Bloom and Stephen finally are able to come together and converse with one another at the end. I'll give some examples in the, I've got a couple of examples of paragraphs from the text itself, and now you get a picture of how the style transforms, at least some picture of it. Beyond that, there's the imminence of myth. The book suggests, the titles of the book suggest, that there's some linkage between what's going on June 16th, 1904, and Homer's Odyssey. But the form that connection has is problematic. The Odyssey is not a simple template for Ulysses. What's going on is not like the relation of West Side Story to Romeo and Juliet, or even the Iliad, the Odyssey to Virgil's Aeneid. Something different. Because although some of the connections are evident, and you can kind of see them, that is, Hades has to do with death. Oh, they're going to a funeral. Okay, that makes sense. So, Aeolus, the king of the winds, and it's a newspaper. Oh, they're windbags. Okay. You see the parallels. But some of the most important and largest correlations are cockeyed or backwards. Bloom is our Odysseus. His wife, Molly, is our Penelope. Stephen is our Telemachus. But Bloom is not a hero. He's not heroic in the ordinary sense. Molly is the opposite of Chase. And Stephen is not their son. So things are cockeyed. Things are strange. Things are cockeyed. Plus, if that weren't enough, gritty 20th century industrial Dublin is not the enchanted world of the Homeric Mediterranean. It's just not. Now, there's nothing new about looking at disparaging comparisons between the banal, harsh reality of modern industrial world and the mythic, romantic past. Think about William Blake bemoaning the dark satanic mills that are besmirching England. Or I think about Max Weber in his talk about the disenchantment of the modern world. That matter right here in Ireland, there the whole movement of the Irish literary renaissance is looking backward at a romantic past or Irish legend and myth. Joyce is not doing that. He's responding to some of the same issues, but in a very, very different way. His characters don't get nostalgic for the past. They don't self-consciously ransack history to recover the sense of significance that they've lost. The arc of the book doesn't go into the past, which is why I think Joyce omitted the Homeric titles from the book. The text focuses on the present with an almost obsessively concrete detail. Some characters do spin away into escapist fantasies. You'll see when you read the book that the men in the chapter Sirens kind of wander off into a haze of alcohol and music. Or the girl on the beach that Bloom sees, her name is Gertie McDowell, and her life consists almost entirely of the world of romantic girls' fantasy magazines. The Cyclops lives in a world of political fantasy, which I think is, I'll stay away from that. Political fantasy, that can get you into trouble. Bloom passes through these episodes rather like Odysseus does. But I think a key word to keep in mind when trying to penetrate the relation of the mythic past to the present in Ulysses is metempsychosis. Now, metempsychosis is a word that Molly finds in a book, and she asks Leopold to explain it to her. It means, of course, a reincarnation or rebirth. It's a strange word to show up in Dublin, but there it is. It sets us to thinking, I think, about Plato. At the end of the Republic, those of you who read the Republic, many of us have, the myth of Ur, at the end of the Republic, Odysseus comes with all the other souls after their purgation to choose his new life. And he chooses the life of a simple man. He says, you was the last person who got a chance to pick his new life. He said, I would have chosen this. It gives us a chance to think, what would Odysseus be like if he were a simple man? What would make him Odysseus? The way in which myth appears in Ulysses is not, I think, like the society created anachronism. It's not moderns pretending to go back into the past. It's the life of the past coming alive again, being alive again in the present, trying to think through what that liveliness that you imagined seeing in the past would be if it came up in this modern world. Bloom begins his day as a henpecked cuckold, but ends it falling asleep beside Molly in a posture that the narrator likens to that of an Indian god. He and Stephen have gone through these tremendous voyages. Well, tremendous, it's been a day, a long day, that begin with their inner, almost solipsistic, lonely monologues, but end with them standing beside one another under what's called, in the words of Ithaca, the heaven tree of stars hung with humid night blue fruit. They've gone into a different kind of place. The way in which myth appears in Ulysses is a kind of an enlivening, not a nostalgia, but an enlivening of this world. It's the third thing that I think is spectacularly valuable in Ulysses. The fourth thing is the humor of it, and I can't really convey that to you. You have to read the book to get it. There are jokes. There are lots of jokes. There are all kinds of jokes. There are puns and wordplay. Joyce hoovered up all of the witticisms he found in all the bars and taverns he drank in, and that's a lot. He loved hyperbole and exaggeration. And then there's the sort of sense of overwhelming positivity about the book as a whole. Some of his humor is an acquired taste. For instance, he loves lists. That takes a while to get used to, but once you get used to it, it's a lot of fun. I once had the opportunity to listen to an actor who recited from memory a page-long list of the names of saints for, I think it's episode 12?
I think it's 12.
Yeah. It was hysterical. Trust me, don't trust me. Anyway, go read it. For better or worse, you'll have to find that, those things out for yourself. I might have mentioned a fifth thing, richness of detail, because that's present in Ulysses as well. Every passage in Ulysses can be unpacked. It can be read at almost any level of magnification. There are dozens of allusions to politics, to history, to geography, to myth, to all sorts of things. The book has been compared to the Irish Book of Kells. This is a page from the Illuminated Manuscript, the Book of Kells, in the sense that there's a big sense, the letter, and then you can look at any letter and go into detail and detail and detail and detail and detail forever, and get lost in single letters. I don't recommend that you do that the first time through. For a first reading, I think it's best not to do it with a microscope. The details are there, and you can go back to them later, which is why I didn't list it, but it's there. those are the four, possibly five things that seem to be that you'll find in Ulysses if you go there. What I'd like to do next is to give a couple of examples of what you'll find when you go there, a few passages. One, two, three, five. I've got five of them. Three of them. Five? Six. Three of them are about the inner monologue and how that works, and the other three are about other things you'll find there. So to begin, you can start at the beginning. Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and laser ray crossed. A yellow dressing gown, ungirdled, was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, Antro ibo ad alpari dei. Now what this is, this is the external narrative voice. It's a blank, kind of minimally informative third-person narrative, characteristic of the opening chapters. The voice tells the events that are happening here and now. It reports the words of the persons who are there, but doesn't really attempt to explain what's happening. For example, where are we? What time is it? Who's Buck Mulligan? What does Antro Ebo Ad Altari Dei mean? Well, it means the beginning of the Catholic Mass in Latin. It means I'll go up to the altar of the Lord. Buck Mulligan, who was a friend of Stevens, it's based on an actual person, Oliver St. John Gogarty. Buck Mulligan is engaged in a blasphemous jocularity, which is sort of what he does. A few moments later, Stephen comes up and joins Mulligan on the roof of the tower, Mulligan is continuing his parody of the Catholic Mass. He peered sideways up and gave a long, slow whistle of call, then paused a while in rapt attention, his even white teeth glistening here and there with gold points. Chrysostomos, two strong, shrill whistles answered through the call. Now, the reason I mention it, this word, Chrysostomos, this, I think, I'm pretty sure, is the first instance of the inner monologue. This is how it happens. There's an outer voice, a third-person voice, and then, unexplained, there'll be intrusions. This is not the inner voice. This is Stephen's thought. And we know it's Stephen's thought because it's obscure. That's what Stephen's thought is. Bloom's thought we'll get to know later. What does it mean? They're not going to tell you. Don't worry about that. You can't just pass it by Nas. Even thinking something obscure. If you happen to know, and this is, again, the levels of microscopicness that you can go into, you can think about Chrysostomos. Those of you who know Greek, there are people in St. John's who know Greek. Chrysostomos comes from Chrysos, means gold. Stomos means mouth. Chrysos Stomos means golden mouth. It was the name given to wonderful preachers, and particularly to St. John Chrysostomos. So Stephen is making some reference to an early saint of the Catholic Church. He's also kind of ironically commenting on Buck Mulligan's dental work. And that's the kind of hyper-educated snark that goes on in Stephen's mind all the time. The balance between the inner voice and the outer voice changes from time to time as the book goes on. Here, you've got one word of inner monologue in an outer frame of third-person narrative. And the third-person narrative tells you about space and time. It tells you where you live, keeps you grounded. At other points, the inner monologue rises up and takes over. Chapter 3, for example, episode 3, Proteus, is almost entirely, not entirely, but almost entirely, largely dominated by Stephen's inner monologue, so much so that it's rather hard to tell where you are or where Stephen is or what's happening. In any three-dimensional physical sense. Fortunately, Stephen is not really all that three-dimensional or physical, so it doesn't much matter. There, the balance changes. For a clearer picture of the sort of thing that happens with the inner monologue, I want to jump ahead to another example from episode 8. This one's Les Dragonians, and we'll go into the inner monologue of Leopold Bloom. Unlike Stephen, Bloom's inner monologue is not, Bloom is not a hyper-sophisticated aesthete. His inner monologue is not littered with references to church history or to Greek literature. His inner voice is simpler. His thoughts often chase after associations sparked by things that he sees or hears, but sometimes they're dragged into reflections or memories. Their expression is choppy. Sentences often get left unfinished. After a while, you get to recognize Bloom's inner voice when you hear it. At times, he may savor some pleasant or bittersweet memory. At other times, you may actually see his voice or his inner voice skirting around some painful memory that he doesn't want to think about. In this case, Bloom is sitting in a restaurant He's just finished his lunch. As he looks at the window and sees two trapped flies, his mind goes back to the day that he proposed to Molly on Hoth Hill, which is a kind of a, well, I suppose in Ireland you call it a mountain, it's a hill, just north of Dublin, from sort of the north edge of Dublin Bay. It's an easy excursion ride for Dublin tourists. Stuck on the pane, two flies buzzed. Stuck. Glowing wine on his palate lingered, swallowed, crushing in the wine press grapes of Burgundy. Sun's heat it is, seems to a secret touch telling me memory. Touched his sense, moistened, remembered, hidden under wild ferns on Hoth, below us bay sleeping, sky, no sound, the sky, the bay purple by the Lion's Head, green by Drumleck, yellow-green towards Sutton, fields of undersea, the lines faint brown in grass, buried cities, pillowed on my coat she had her hair, earwigs in the heather, scrub my hand under her nape, you'll toss me all. Oh, wonder, cool soft with ointments her hand touched me, caressed, her eyes upon me, did not turn away. Ravished over her I lay, full lips, full open, kissed her mouth. Yum. Softly she gave me in my mouth the seed cake, warm and chewed, mawkish pulp, her mouth had mumbled, sweet sour of her spittle. Joy, I ate it, joy. Young life, her lips that gave me, pouting, soft, warm, sticky, gum jelly lips, flowers her eyes were, take me, willing eyes. Pebbles fell, she lay still. A goat, no one. High on Ben Hoth, rhododendrons, a nanny goat, walking sure-footed, dropping currants. Screened under ferns, she laughed, warm, folded. Wildly, I lay on her, kissed her, eyes, her lips, her stretched neck beating, woman's breasts full in her blouse of nun's veiling, fat nipples upright. Hot, I tongued her, she kissed me, I was kissed. All yielding, she tossed my hair, kissed, she kissed me. Me, and me now. Stuck, the flies buzzed. The exchange of the half-eaten seed cake reflects the food motif that goes all throughout Lestragonians. It echoes ancient marriage rituals and is still around in the form of wedding cakes. Bloom is often down to earth, but he has a sort of a sensual tenderness that we hear directly here. His thoughts rise to ecstatic heights only to slam down to the cruel reality of the present. Me and me.
Excuse me, no. This is just an accident, sorry.
Okay. The trapped buzzing flies bracket the bleak reality of here and now.
I'm sorry, I do have to go. That's where I'm on for my ride.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
Glad you could come for part. Bloom is not always so ecstatic or so morose as we see him here. The inner monologue follows the character's thoughts and moods from moment to moment. As dejected as he is here, there are other passages where he's curious or happy or charitable or gruesome or gentle or randy or fearful or defiant. He's as various as Stephen is, but in a different, somewhat more sensual register. In all cases, though, the inner monologue places a very intimate connection and conveys to us a feeling of the loneliness, and I think it's here, the loneliness of Bloom as he's remembering the proposal to his wife and thinking also about the presence of the threat of the affair that's taking place today, that he knows of and fears. As we turn toward the second half of the book, we get away from the inner monologue. The inner monologue recedes, and the external voice abandons its sort of flat, unadorned here and now form of presentation. And takes on a more flamboyant and stylistic excess. In fact, the external-internal dichotomy that I'm kind of playing up, I probably overstated it in a way, but I think it's there. But it's never really so simple and complete as you might the inner monologue wants to pretend it to be. No one who thought the outer world was some sort of an indifferent Cartesian extended manifold could have expended so much effort on describing its minutiae as Joyce does. His passion for the particular details of daily life in Dublin is legendary. He once famously remarked that he, quote, wanted to give a picture of Dublin so complete that if the city suddenly disappeared from the earth, it could be reconstructed from Ulysses. One of the charms that Ulysses has is the opportunity to relocate yourself back into that fully realized past world. I was fortunate with my wife to be able last year to visit Dublin on Bloom's Day. And you see people walking about in Edwardian costume, enjoying the day. I think there's some of them are certainly, I've got a number of them, are celebrating the works of Joyce and the language of Joyce, but they're also engaged in the nostalgia for that time and that place, which is so fully captured. One feature of that time and that place that gives it its reality is the music. Music permeates Ulysses. And generally, though I don't like relying on external sources for readings, I make an exception here. All readers of Ulysses should seek out and listen to the music that's referred to. It gives a dimension to the book that's wonderful and delightful should not be missed. There are hundreds of songs that are mentioned in Ulysses, and about a dozen, we could argue, that play a prominent role in what's going on. Just to give one illustration, I want to take you to one of the most prominent pieces. It's an aria from a popular comic opera, Mapari, from the opera Martha by the German composer Friedrich von Flotow. Translated into English, it becomes a tenor aria called Martha, O Return Love. And this should be it. Listen now to how that song weaves itself into a climactic moment from episode 11 in Sirens. Bloom is in the dining room of the Ormond Hotel. Through connecting doors, you can hear men talking and singing in the bar, lost in the sentimental power of alcohol and music. Among them is Simon Dedalus, Stephen Dedalus's ne'er-do-well father, who performs this song. Meanwhile, Bloom is aware that Blaze's boiling is at this very moment of the room with Molly. The song moves Bloom's mind between his present circumstances and happier times with Molly. Oh, and by the way, Lionel, will come up in this, is the name of the character in the opera who's singing this song in Italian. Each graceful look, first night when I saw her at Matt Dillon's in Terra Nur, yellow, black lace she wore, musical chairs, we two the last, fate, after her, fate. Round and round, slow, quick, round, we two, all looked, halt, down she sat, all ousted, looked, lips laughing, yellow knees. Charmed my eye, singing, waiting, she sang, I turned her music, full voice of perfume, of what perfume does your lilac trees? Bosom I saw, both full, throat warbling, first I saw, she thanked me, why did she me? Fate, Spanishy eyes, under a pear tree alone patio this hour in old Madrid, one side in shadow, Dolores, she Dolores, at me, ah, alluring, Dolores, she Dolores is a reference to a song that's occurred earlier in the episode that, it's unclear how Bloom knows it, it may be the external voice melding, because Martha, ah, Martha, quitting all languor, Lionel cried in grief and cry of passion dominant to love to return with deepening yet with rising chords of harmony. In cry of Lionel loneliness that she should know must Martha feel for only her he waited. Where? Here, there, try, there, here, all, try, where? Somewhere. Come, thou lost one, come, thou dear one, alone, one love, one hope. The narrative voice is indistinguishable from the cry of Bloom. One comfort me, Martha, chestnut, return. Come, its sword, a bird, it held its flight, a swift, pure cry, soar, silver orb, it leaped serene, speeding, sustained. To come, don't spin it out too long, long breath, he breath, long life. Soaring high, high, resplendent, aflame, crowned high in the effulgent symbolistic, high of the ethereal bosom, high of the high vast irradiation, everywhere, all soaring, all around, about the all, the endlessness, to me, Sioppold, consumed. The narrative voice entirely abandons its bland reporter's gaze. It grasps for the emotive power of the moment, falling over syntax as it stretches the expressiveness of words far beyond their breaking points. The narrative voice is not limited to what is present here and now. In the climactic moment, Simon Dedalus and Leopold Bloom fuse into an emotive whole, Sioppold. And the longing of the operatic Lionel joins the despair of Leopold Bloom in the dining room of the hotel. Consumed, the narrator says, and all the meanings of that word, sexual consummation between Blazes and Molly, but also Bloom's being swallowed and destroyed, annihilated, are expressed together. Whatever else is going on, this experience of the world is not the simple division of inner monologue thoughts and unexpressive exterior reality. Bloom has moved into a new and potentially dangerous kind of world. Now, for something completely different. I'd like to move next to my penultimate example. This one is from episode 12, Cyclops. Cyclops is told in a very different narrative style. It's told by a nameless barfly who speaks in sort of low Irish slang. The action of the chapter occurs in a pub that's presided over by a figure known as the Citizen, a fervent Irish nationalist, a hater of all things British, and by extension, all things foreign. The citizen's utter lack of perspective qualifies him and his followers to be the Cyclopses of the episode's title. The narrative peculiarity of Cyclops is the sporadic appearance of wildly exaggerated, strangely distorted parodies in the text. From time to time, the low Irish slang of the narrator jolts unexpectedly into the imitation of, well, a variety of things: Irish epic, newspaper accounts, scientific reports, the minutes of public bodies, there's a bill of lading at one point, poetry composed by a dog, that's just to name a few. The leaps in tone are humorous, I think, but they also mimic the mentality of the citizen who passes his time in this grimy public house, but whose grandiose self-image struts on some imaginary stage as a world historical figure. So by way of illustration, I want to turn to the very end of Cyclops. Bloom has gotten crosswise with the citizen, which is easy to do, especially for someone who is a Jew. He's being chased out of the bar, and the citizen is throwing heavy objects at his head and sicking his dog, named Gary Owen, after him. Bloom beats a hasty retreat, as we hear from our narrator in the final moments. "You never saw the like of it in all your born puff. Gob, if he got that lottery ticket on the side of his paw, he'd remember the gold cup he would so. But by God, the citizen would have been lagged for assault and battery, and Joe for aiding and abetting. The Jarvie saved his life by furious driving, as sure as God made Moses. What, oh Jesus, he did. And he let a volley of oaths after him. Did I kill him, says he, or what? And he shouting to the bloody dog, after him, Gary, after him, boy. And the last we saw was the bloody car round in the corner, an old sheep's faced on it, gesticulating, and the bloody mongrel after him with his lugs back for all he was bloody well worth to tear him limb from limb. 105, Jesus, he took the value of it out of him, I promise you. When lo, there came about them all a great brightness, and they beheld the chariot wherein he stood ascend to heaven. And they beheld him in the chariot, clothed upon in the glory of the brightness, having raiment as of the sun, fair as the moon, and terrible that for awe they durst not look upon him. And there came a voice out of heaven calling, Elijah, Elijah. And he answered with a main cry, Abba, Adonai. And they beheld him, even him, Ben Bloom Elijah, amid clouds of angels, ascend to the glory of the brightness at an angle of 45 degrees over Donahue's in Little Green Street, like a shot of a shot. What just happened? Well, easy. Bloom has been ascended, has been assumed into heaven. And you can think about whatever you like, but I'll tell you, it's not the strangest thing that happens to him that day. At the very least, it should be clear that we have left behind the world of the interior monologue, where the outer world appears as a bland Cartesian extension. The structure of Bloom's world has become seriously unhinged. There are dozens of other passages that I would love to share, but I don't want to keep, you know, people beyond their patience. I'll limit myself to just one more. It's probably the most famous passage in the book. It's the final words of Molly Bloom's monologue. Molly's voice is not like anyone that we've heard before. It's not scholarly like Stevens, nor chopped and fragmented like Leopold's. Molly's voice flows in eight enormous continuous paragraphs, unmarred by pause, grammar, or punctuation. Her voice gives a novel perspective to the hopes, thoughts, fears, and suspicions that have occurred in Leopold's mind during the day as she wanders among her memories of girlhood in Gibraltar, the men she knew or wanted to know, her afternoon with Boylan, her plans and her desires, sexual and social. As the dawn begins to show outside the window, Molly thinks back to her first kiss that she got from a naval officer in Gibraltar, a memory that blends into the afternoon on Hovehead with Leopold when he proposed to her, the same afternoon that he was thinking about in that passage from Les Fredonians. Oh, and the sea, crimson sometimes like fire, and the glorious sunset, and the fig trees in the Alameda Gardens, yes, and all the queer little streets, and the pink and the blue and the yellow houses, and the rose gardens, and the jessamine and geraniums, and the cactuses, and Gibraltar as a girl where I was a flower of the mountain, yes, when I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used, or shall I wear a red, yes, and how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, Then I thought as well him as another, and then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes. And then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me, so he could feel my breast all perfume, yes. And his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said, yes, I will, yes. That's the end of the book. Martha and I, when we were in Dublin, heard a tour guide, a young man, reading this passage on the steps of the house directly across the street from where Bloom's house, number 7 Acker Street, has been destroyed. It's now a hospital. But the house across the street is still there. It looks much the same. And he was standing there. He read this passage. And at the end he said, I've always enjoyed talking about my perfume breasts in public. I can understand that. So why read Ulysses? Because it is an enormous world available for exploration. Because the variety and extravagance of the prose is like nothing you can find elsewhere. Because the characters of Molly, Stephen, and especially Leopold offer endless, and to my experience, uplifting occasion for reflection. Because the book speaks to perennial questions about how the banal particulars of daily reality are infused and enlivened by the past, as 20th century is shaped by Homeric Greece, without being subdued or dominated by it. Because in the midst of the grimy modern reality, Joyce has created a work of universal scope, fabulous humor, and life-affirming joy. But how to read Ulysses? Well, I've got a few tips. Number one, chapter by chapter, episode by episode, Ulysses is not a book to be binge-read. Each episode stands alone to some degree, not entirely, but to some degree, and is worth savoring by itself. So go slowly. Second, listen to the music. It's available on the internet. All you have to do is type in Joyce, Ulysses, music, and things will pop up. Easy to find. There are recordings on recordings of all the songs and the albums of collected music. Don't snoop the books on tape. There are books on tape renditions. You can dissect and read Ulysses in mind-numbing detail in small pieces, but for a first reading, I think it's best to get a picture of the whole. And for that, books on tape are very helpful, especially for Molly's monologue, which has no punctuation. That's a hard one for the eyes. Ox and the Sun is not easy. But all the episodes can benefit from a well-informed actor who knows what's going on and wants to contribute to your understanding. They're quite worthwhile. Use references sparingly. There are lots of references. And if you get lost, it's useful to have a book like this. This is Ulysses annotated by Don Gifford, but there are others, and there are online resources as well. Gifford often tells you what you want to know, and even more often tells you more than you want to know. But it's useful to have something like this around. For the first time through, it's, I think, valuable, particularly when listening to Stephen, to be able to say to yourself, oh, that's just Stephen being scholastic and nonsense, and just roll on past, but sometimes you don't want to do that. Finally, and this is the most important, get a group. In my experience, reading Ulysses with groups has many benefits. For one, get to go together with a group and you have an audience to complain to about how much difficulty you had, and then you can sympathize with that. But the passages that you have particular problems are oftentimes the ones that other people say, oh, well, I thought this, and then you can get into it. It's really helpful. The St. John's method of collective reading is very helpful. That's my experience, and I'm not being paid any kickback to say that. If you're going to be around Santa Fe next semester or next year, I'm going to be leading a Ulysses reading group at lunchtime. I'm not sure what day, depending on my schedule. If you want to go a little bit slower, Adam Harvey here has a reading group that meets on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Right now it's meeting down at the Santa Fe Public Library. It may outgrow that venue, we don't know. But you can find it at joycegeek.com or just put in Joyce Reading Group Santa Fe and the web, probably you'll find it. If you want to read slower, there's a podcast. It's not a reading group, it's a podcast. By a fellow by the name of Frank Delaney, who's going through Ulysses. He's projecting to get through it in 25 years. He's now in episode 8, I think. But you can do that. But however you do it, just to conclude, James Joyce, whose ego was every bit as big as Stephen Dedalus's, once said, quote, "The demand that I make of my reader is that he should devote his whole life to reading my works." That's a tall order. Joyce was probably joking. He joked about most things. But there are certainly worse ways to spend your life. So I recommend trying Ulysses.